our need to really transition relative to so many other countries and our relative ability to do so as a rich global North country who's got us into this mess in the first place.
There's an excerpt from a new episode of Bubble Pop. Find the show archives wherever you get your podcasts at rachelgilmore.substack.com and at harbingermedianetwork.com. You listen to Harbinger showcasing your local campus and community radio station. I'm Andre Goulet in Montreal. This episode's brought to you by the Alberta Advantage and by Canadian progressive journalism community unrigged.ca. Coming up next. Broadcasting since 2022, The Breach Show is a bi-weekly podcast featuring sharp commentary on politics and movements in Canada. On this excerpt from a new episode, Nisrin Elamin and Ismail Adam join Desmond Cole to talk about how decades of Canadian mining interests and weapon smuggling has made Canada complicit in the war in Sudan. Now, here's Desmond.
Welcome to The Breach Show, featuring sharp analysis on politics and social movements in Canada. I'm your host, Desmond Cole. The ongoing war in Sudan has escalated in recent weeks as the Rapid Support Forces, or RSF, a powerful paramilitary group, has strengthened its position in North Darfur, in the western part of Sudan. The RSF has engaged in civilian massacres in this region, and they've been using weapons made in Canada. As war has raged on for over 2 years, Canada's complicity in bloodshed has led to condemnations and, recently, hearings at the Canadian Senate, but very little action. Will Canada take accountability for its role in a war that has claimed up to 400,000 lives? Will the government stop sending weapons that end up in Sudan and accept more refugees from that country? Joining me to speak about all of this today is Ismail Adam, the president of the Darfur Association of Canada, and Nisrin Elamin, assistant professor of anthropology at the University of Toronto and a co-founder of the Sudan Solidarity Collective. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for being here. Ismail, I'd like to begin with you, please. Could you help us to understand the significance of the RSF gaining ground against the Sudanese armed forces in Darfur and what it means for the civilian population that is still trapped inside that area?
Just let me give you a little bit more background. So RSF, it's known to be the Janjaweed. They have committed all the atrocities and the genocide in early 2000s, between 2003 and 2005. And they were used as proxy by the government in Sudan. At that time, it was Omar al-Bashir's regime. And at that time, it is estimated to have killed over 300,000 people and displaced over 2.5 million people, in which that even after the war stopped, up to date, there are about 2 million still living in IDP camps and some camps in the neighboring countries. So the RSF, it is known to have committed these crimes in Darfur, and they kept committing it. It is not the only the Al-Fashir now. 3 years ago, they have also decimated a city called the Junaina, and then neighboring cities called Krindeng 1 and Krindeng 2. And the main thing for them is that they are after specifically areas that are rich in gold, like an area called Jabal Moon in the Krindeng near Junaina. They displaced, they killed so many people, they attacked and decimated that city for the simple goal, just to drive the people out of it. So the RSF has all this history of perpetrating all these crimes in Darfur. And one of the main reasons that they kept doing this, because the lack of accountability and for them to act with impunity, this is what one of the main reasons that these type of atrocities, they kept recurring. I mentioned early 2000s and now, it is that they get in the past backed by the military government, but now they are becoming the proxies for foreign governments that have interests in Sudan and in Darfur. And it is not only Al-Fashir, it is just that Darfur is the like usually joined with five districts, and Al-Fashir is the last district to fall in their hands. They have done similar things in the other districts as well, and Al-Fashir was the last stronghold that was under siege for over 18 months until it fell. My own cousin died like 3 weeks ago in Al-Fashir when a shell fell in their home. So a lot of people, like many, many thousands of people have lost their lives. Many have fled the region. And the ones that left inside, they're kind of trapped inside. And some of them, sadly, you know, feed themselves in animal feed if they can find it. So the starvation and famine is very rampant. And the diseases are, you know, again, that's another way of people losing their lives. So it is really a dire situation now.
I'm very sorry to hear about the loss of your cousin. Nasreen, I'd like to ask you, we hear different descriptions about this war between the RSF, as we've mentioned, and the Sudanese armed forces as being the two main groups who have been in conflict for the last more than 2 years now. And many describe this conflict between the two as a civil war, but others, including yourself, prefer to refer to this as a counter-revolutionary war. Can you explain what it is that you mean by that?
I mean, I think it's important to understand that that Sudan experienced a really powerful popular revolution in 2019 that overthrew the dictatorship of Omar al-Bashir after 30 years in power, the same dictatorship that essentially co-coordinated, right, the genocide that Ismail was just talking about in the early 2000s in Darfur, where the military and the Janjaweed at the time, now known as the RSF, kind of worked together to commit genocide. There was a transitional government after the revolution ousted al-Bashir. It was a power-sharing kind of government between civilian and military elites, the military elites being al-Burhan, the head of the army, and Hemeti, the head of the RSF. So they were in a kind of partnership transitional government, but power was always tilted in favor of military elites. And so during that transitional period, you saw efforts to kind of move closer towards democratic elections and civilian oversight, for example, over economic assets that these military elites control. And of course, you know, the military elites were against that and ended up orchestrating a coup together in October of 2021. So the RSF and SAF essentially upended that process that was supposed to lead towards civilian rule and democratic elections by staging this coup. And it's in the aftermath of that coup that the UN-led peace talks that really kind of centered and legitimized the coup leaders, both Burhan and Hemeti are responsible for war crimes that span decades, kind of framing them as potential reformists rather than listening to people on the streets, including the resistance committees. There's about 8,000 of them across the country that really formed the backbone of the revolution. And these are like these kind of non-hierarchical, consensus-based collectives that have been not only organizing boycotts and strikes and protests against the military coup regime, but also providing people basic services in the absence of a kind of functional state. And so the resistance committees were really calling for no legitimacy, no partnership with the military. And of course, you know, the UN peace talks did the opposite by kind of centering and legitimizing them. And I just want to also add to what Ismail was saying before. The Janjaweed became formalized as the RSF in 2013 by the al-Bashir regime. Al-Bashir was really trying to coup-proof his rule against the army, given Sudan's long history of military coups. So he thought, I'm going to create something that will protect me against a potential military coup. And it was further legitimized by the European Union through something called the Khartoum process, which was a kind of migratory control process whereby the EU has been trying to externalize its border to the border between Sudan and Libya and essentially paid the Bashir regime about $200 million to use the RSF as its border control. And the RSF has also been used to fight in the war on Yemen on the Saudi coalition's behalf. So all of this to say that in April of 2023, the military coup regime basically imploded and split in two, with each faction vying for kind of political and economic control of the country. And so for me, this is really an internationalized counter-revolutionary war that is meant to foreclose the possibility of civilian rule and popular democracy as has been articulated by the resistance committees. And it's internationalized because of the international backers of these two parties, right? On the one hand, you have the UAE supporting the RSF in exchange for gold. They're shipping in weapons. And on the other hand, you have the army being supported by Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Iran, Turkey. And, you know, neither of these sides are interested in civilian rule, which is why I would call this a war against civilians rather than a civil war.
Thank you for that explanation. It's really helpful. Ismail, we know that Canadian weapons shipped to the United Arab Emirates have made their way into Sudan. We know about the strong relationship between the United Arab Emirates and the RSF, who trades gold and other resources for weapons. And we know about Canada's strong relationship with the United Arab Emirates. In fact, Mark Carney just visited the Emirates last week and announced a $70 billion trade agreement between the two countries. But he didn't say a word about Sudan. What do you make of his silence as the United Arab Emirates fuels the war in Sudan?
Canada is free to sign kind of trades, but human rights needs to be respected, even for the best interest of Canada, not to have ties with its own companies that reside here in Canada, have ties to a genocide or ethnic cleansing. That will just distort the image of Canada itself. So as we probably have read that there are multiple Canadian companies, manufacturers like the Sterling Cross, which like manufactured rifles that seem carried by the RSF, and the Strad Group, which manufactures armored vehicles, also seen carrying RSF troops. And yet, like a country that is known to be peacebuilding country, a country that one of the G7, a country that all established democracy. I mean, not to tackle this issue and have governance around the arms that have been manufactured in Canada, I think that's a huge wrong. And I think that is really, Canada should really look at this and set up, according to the trade act that we have, the export and import trade, they can tighten the screws around this. There are also some like a bill currently in flight, the Jenny Kwan's bill, although there's some controversy about the arm trades and stuff like that, but it closes the loophole of the re-export of arms. And I think it is necessary that these needs to be stopped and Canada needs to provide like this oversight, this complicity, and it kills more people and it's hurting us as Sudanese families because our people get killed by sniper that is made in our second home, that is Canada. I think that's wrong and needs to stop.
Nisrin, you spoke at a recent Senate committee hearing yourself about Canada's role in the violence in Sudan, and you listed several demands, one of which was an immediate arms embargo on Canadian weapons that are likely to make it to Sudan, particularly through the United Arab Emirates. How was that message received by the Senate committee that you spoke to?
In terms of how the message was received in the Senate, I wanted to just mention that part of why people were listening was because, you know, one of the members of our Sudan Solidarity Collective, Shahad Al-Faqih, broke the story alongside a couple of other journalists in CBC that Sterling Cross rifles, Canadian Sterling Cross rifles are being used. And so obviously now that information is public, you know, the Canadian government feels the need to address this. And part of their concern was legal complicity, right? Can we be held accountable for these weapons ending up being used in an ethnic cleansing campaign against indigenous communities in Darfur.
Yeah, so I think that question being asked by one of the senators, actually, yes.
Yeah, exactly. So I think that's where that motivation is coming from, which, you know, the straight armored vehicle story was, I think, was broke like maybe a year or two ago. I mean, this has long been a sort of, like, we as the Sudanese community have known this for a long time. I think it's happening. The one of the things that was really instrumental about that story is that it broke just as things were escalating in Darfur and there was kind of media attention on it. There's been a virtual media blackout on kind of what's happening in Sudan, partly due to anti-Black racism, but also because the allies in this case, you know, the UAE is one of Canada's largest trading partners. And like Ismail was saying, you know, Canada's prioritizing that relationship. And also, I should say, the Abrams Accord, right? This kind of normalization with Israel accords over the lives of Sudanese civilians. And that's a shame. I mean, it's something that needs to get further exposed. I don't believe that a settler colonial government will do what's best without pressure, right? We need the Canadian public, including Sudanese Canadians, but also non-Sudanese, to apply that pressure, to say Canada can actually stop its complicity in this genocide in Darfur and in the broader war in Sudan.
There's always, you know, the profit will be the guiding force behind these companies. And unless there is a framework that clearly governs all the trade deals, especially the arms, this is not going to stop.
There's a highlight from a new episode of The Breach Show. Listen to the rest of the interview wherever you get your podcasts at harbingermedianetwork.com and find more journalism for transformation at breachmedia.ca. You're listening to Harbinger Showcase on your local campus and community radio station. This episode is brought to you by The Alberta Advantage. And finally, Progress Report from Edmonton-based public interest journalism outlet Progress Alberta has been detailing the good and mostly bad of Alberta politics since 2019. On this highlight from a new episode, co-host Jim Story speaks with The Breach managing editor and Avi Lewis NDP leadership campaign advisor Martin Lukacs, one of the activists involved with the LEAP manifesto at the federal NDP's 2016 convention in Edmonton. Now, here's Jim.
Friends and enemies, welcome to another episode of The Pod. I'm Jim Story, hosting today from Amiskwichiwiskaigan, otherwise known as Edmonton in Treaty 6 territory, here in Alberta, Canada. It's Thursday, November 27th, and it has been a minute. I've been off on sick leave for a big chunk of the month, and Alberta sure did not stop Albertaing while I was away. We've got the provincial government firing the notwithstanding clause off in every direction, Alberta's teachers securing a historic strike mandate and then backing down, Kilmaggan threatening a general strike that he couldn't deliver and promising an unprecedented response from Labour that has turned out to be a very precedented bunch of town halls and advertisements. We've got recall campaigns underway against over a dozen MLAs. UCP taking an axe to Aish and to trans rights. Mark Carney this week jumping in to give Danielle Smith a hand by offering her a pipeline that may or may not actually get built. The UCP annual general meeting is coming up this weekend, and that's sure to be heavily protested. I can't chew through all of this in a single episode. I think probably the best way to proceed is to just get back to it where we left off last time. The last episode, we spoke with Shannon Phillips about the conflict between the Alberta NDP and the eco-socialist organizers of the LEAP Manifesto all the way back in 2016. And I promised you then that we'd do a follow-up with someone on the LEAP side. That's what we'll be talking about today. My guest is Martin Lukacs, managing editor with The Breach, who was involved with LEAP back then and is serving as a policy advisor on Avi Lewis's federal NDP leadership race today. We recorded an interview earlier this month. Before I cut to that, I've been remiss lately in not shouting out our friends at the Harbinger Media Network. Harbinger is a collection of podcasts across the country who have a left-wing perspective. If you're looking for more good pod content to consume, head over to their website at harbingermedianetwork.com, and you'll find a collection of great stuff from all over Canada, including Albertan material like the Progress Report or our friends over at the Alberta Advantage. Harbinger's got a similar thing going for written articles too at unrigged.ca. It's my browser handpage, and it could be yours too. Okay, well, I'd like to welcome our guest for today, Martin Lukacs from The Breach. Martin, how are you doing today?
Doing great. Thanks so much.
The Breach, if you're unfamiliar with it, folks, is a media platform from out east doing mission journalism, very similar to the work we do at the Progress Report. Old friend of the show, Desmond Cole, along with many other luminaries, are on the masthead over there. So I would recommend go check them out. But the topic of the day, of course, is not The Breach, but a follow-up to our last episode where we talked to Shannon Phillips about the lingering resentment over the introduction of the LEAP manifesto at the NDP convention years ago and why that seems to be coloring the present-day federal NDP race, which looks at the moment to be a race between Avi Lewis and Heather McPherson. So, Martin, you were closely involved with LEAP when it came to convention. Can you wind us back to maybe a little bit before the manifesto arrives at convention and tell us that story from the beginning.
Yeah, sure. So the LEAP was born, the LEAP manifesto was born out of a process back in spring 2015 when Naomi Klein, Avi Lewis, myself, and a few others invited activists from social movements around the country to a gathering in Toronto. There were about 60 people from Indigenous communities, labor unions, environmental groups, migrant justice organizations. And the thinking was to articulate a joint position about how to combat climate change in a way that would make our society more just, caring, and equal. Part of the motivation was that we felt that social movements in this country were extremely siloed and divided. And it was a modest effort to try to generate some common ground between these different organizations and groups and movements. And one of the other big motivating factors was the climate crisis. Back in 2015, there was an oil price crash. And, you know, part of the thinking at the time was that this was as good a moment as any other to seize, to kickstart a transition off of oil. So for instance, you know, no less than a radical left-wing rag like The Economist at the time had suggested that the oil price collapse was a, quote, once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to transform what was a dysfunctional energy system. And so, you know, we put out this statement that in some ways was, you know, in keeping with the mainstream of social democratic policy that the NDP had put out over many years, with a bit of extra touch of poetry in a way that might connect to people. And, you know, it involved calling for things like a more caregiving oriented economy, deeper investments in green energy, universal childcare, a debate about a guaranteed annual income. And it also included the demand that became the most contentious, which was no more pipelines, no new fossil fuel infrastructure. And it's kind of funny that in the fracas over that eventually ensued, the media and a lot of commentators actually missed some of the more radical proposals that were in there. For instance, there was a call for, you know, an alternative to the price gouging, profit gouging of private companies in Canada, and that we should start developing public alternatives that were democratically run, that paid a living wage. And we argued in the document too that the energy transition itself should be run through the democratic participation of workers, impacted workers themselves. And I think when the document was eventually released in the fall of 2015, during the federal election, when Thomas Mulcair was racing to the right of the political spectrum and allowing the NDP to be outflanked by Justin Trudeau, who we of course know carried the day and won a majority government. And in the aftermath of that, you know, disastrous result for the NDP in that election, a lot of grassroots NDP activists gravitated towards the LEAP because I think it spoke to them about that political moment, not just, I think, the politics that it was proposing around the climate crisis, but it spoke to, you know, the battle over the soul of the NDP that, you know, was kicking up again in the wake of Thomas Mulcair's, you know, very conservative leadership of the party. And it, I think, spoke to a lot of people in the way that, you know, gave them, it was a signal of a potential left-wing, more grassroots turn in the way that Bernie Sanders at the time was doing politics in the States and Jeremy Corbyn was doing politics in the UK. And that kind of unapologetically, unabashedly progressive outlook attracted people. And And outside of our control or even our intention, NDP activists basically brought it to the federal convention, which at the time was to take place in Alberta. And then, of course, fireworks ensued.
Yeah. Did you anticipate conflict with the Alberta NDP over this?
I wouldn't say we anticipated it. It was clear that there were political differences between the vision that the LEAP manifesto articulated and what the Alberta NDP, and certainly even the federal NDP up until that point, was doing politically. I do think that, you know, one of the stories being told about Avi Lewis in all of this is that the LEAP manifesto was, you know, emblematic of a immature, politically unskilled, uncompromising, uncooperative political operator. And I think it's actually worth describing in a bit more detail some of the record around that, because it doesn't really bear out that story. So, you know, the LEAP itself emerged out of collaboration and compromise. So, you know, there were dozens of labor unions involved in the drafting, including the president of QP at the time, the head of the Canadian Labor Congress, and Unifor actually was in there too, which represented oil sands workers in Fort McMurray. And in the aftermath of that convening in the spring of 2015 that I described, you know, Jerry Diaz, then the president of Unifor, and Naomi Klein and others shared a political stage. A high-ranking Unifor advisor actually was in the draft of the document.
There's an excerpt from a new episode of The Progress Report. Find the more than 150 episode archives at progressreport.ca and at harbingermedianetwork.com. Listen to Harbinger Showcase on your local campus and community radio station. This episode's been brought to you by Unrigged. Learn more about Canada's coalition of more than 30 progressive news publishers and get all your independent Canadian journalism in one place at unrigged.ca. And by the Alberta Advantage. Find the show's almost 9 years of archived episodes at albertaadvantagepod.com, at harbingermedianetwork.com, or wherever you get your podcasts. Follow us on Instagram and Blue Sky for updates on new episodes, and subscribe to the Harbinger newsletter for a weekly Wednesday roundup from Canada's cross-country community of 83 socially and politically progressive podcasts. We'll be back with a new episode next week. Until then, I'm Harbinger director Andre Goulet in Montreal. Now, back to your regularly scheduled community radio station programming.
Bird note. Sometimes birds change their tune. For example, white-throated sparrows in many areas have shortened their songs in just a few decades. But there are also songs that appear to have stayed the same over millennia. Several related species of sunbirds in eastern Africa live on isolated mountaintops, also known as sky islands. Their mountaintop habitats led them to become distinct populations and, in some cases, evolve into different species. But researchers found that two populations of one species, the forest double-collared sunbird, still have nearly identical songs, despite having separated into different mountains at least 500,000 years ago. That suggests the song that these sunbirds sing today is probably very similar to that of their long-lost ancestors. The findings show that there are good reasons for a species to keep singing the same old song. Having a unique and stable song helps birds recognize members of their own species, even if their ancestors split up long ago. So, if a tune works, don't change it. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.